Well, Tariq El-Shabazz, welcome to Newsworks tonight. When you made your announcement, I wasn't there, but I read that you called yourself the perfect candidate for DA. True?
That is true.
And in what way?
Well, because I come with a certain level of experience. I've been 30 years into criminal work. In 30 years, I've practiced as a assistant district attorney, as the first assistant district attorney, and for 2 decades as a criminal defense attorney. My experience in the community in which I grew up, in the community that I engender myself to, coaching football or doing otherwise, gives me, I think, the well-rounded view of how to fix this office.
Tell us a bit about your background, where you grew up, how you got here.
I grew up in the projects in Bedford-Stuyvesant, Brooklyn, New York, Brevoort Houses, the youngest of 4 siblings, raised primarily by my mother. Went to high school in Brooklyn in Bedford-Stuyvesant, but I went to elementary school and middle school in Bensonhurst. So I was kind of bused from North Philadelphia to Northeast, far Northeast.
Bensonhurst is a white community farther down in Brooklyn, yeah. Uh-huh.
It is, and a tremendous public education there. From there, I went to Hofstra University on a partial scholarship. I was supposed to be a communications major, doing the things that you're doing now. But somewhere along the lines, in the 80s, I became involved in activities that involved students, from protesting to writing for the newspaper to being the head of the African People's Organization, which was an African-American student organization, and then got the desire to go to law school basically because of the experiences I had during the course of the projects and growing up in the projects, but also for the first time actually realizing that I can actually get there. Always had the ability to speak and talk to people and talk our way out of things. I think that was one of my gems and claims to fame to being in the project. And I had a very strong-willed mother. And as a result of that, I decided to go to University of Baltimore Law Center now, but law school, because they gave me the most money to go there. And my experience there led me to litigation.
A couple of times in speaking to juries, you've talked about your an early encounter with the justice system of your own.
Yeah. Sometimes we make crazy decisions, and there was a time period in which I went with some friends, and my friends were involved in doing some things they had no business doing, shoplifting. And as a result of that, it wasn't a situation where you actually were arrested, but people took you and your names, and then you were required to go to a program.
You're like 12, 13.
Yeah, sort of like a little younger than that, actually about 11. Go to a Scared Straight program. And going through that particular program, you had an opportunity to talk with lifers, to deal with lifers. And the objective of that program was to scare you straight. I was intimidated. Let's be very, very clear. I was intimidated with prison. At that point, I had never went to a prison to see anyone. So that was my first encounter. And there were people that were tough with it, didn't bother them, but I didn't want that. And that experience, I think, refocused me. It had me focusing on what was important and to stay away from those things that weren't. And in the projects, it was a little bit different in the community. If people saw that you had a gift, they saw that you were prominent, whether it's basketball, football, boxing, or education, you know, people would look out for you. So some of the same guys that may have been involved in something that wasn't good, when they wanted to do something, they would send me upstairs. Get out of here. We don't want you around here. Sort of protecting.
They would send you away so that you wouldn't
get messed up
in things.
So those experiences actually helped me and fashioned me. And I never liked to fail. You know, my mother was a stickler for education. She worked in education, so I worked hard. I did well in school. And each juncture of my life when there was a very tough decision or a life-changing decision to make, I've always had someone there that actually helped me and aided me in making the right decisions, from the individuals that Scared Straight to coaches, boxing and football, to my parents, to dean of the university at Hofstra University.
So you graduated law school in Baltimore, came to Philly and worked. You know, I heard you say in a debate at one point, when the discussion was what police misconduct is like for people in a community, that you didn't have to just read about this, that you experienced it, that you had been hit on the head by a police flashlight.
Oh, yeah.
What happened?
You can't grow up in the projects and run from police and don't get hit in the head by something. Doing something I had no business. I was hanging out in the lobby. They wouldn't let you loiter in the lobby.
Because this was in New York and Bedford Stuyvesant.
In New York, in Brooklyn, yeah. Bedford Stuyvesant. Because people would be afraid to come into the building. And when it was cold, we're outside, but we're outside in the building, so you're not really outside. And we were asked to leave. And I never disrespected Officer Johns, and I talk about Officer Johns a lot, but somebody did say something to Officer Johns. Officer Johns was in very good shape because he was able to catch you. So he catch you, you know, he bop you a little bit. But even if he bops you a little bit, when I say hitting the head with a flashlight, I didn't get my head split open. That didn't happen. But I actually felt the flashlight on the back of my head. And he takes you up to your house, to your mother, and tell your mother he was hanging in the lobby. I told him to leave. He didn't leave. I caught him, and I roughed him up a little bit. Mother didn't have any problem. In fact, most of the time, if I told her that, and he told her that, then I think she would rough me up a little bit as well. But she knew that because Officer Johns is the same type of officer that would take care of you. If, in fact, you were thirsty from playing basketball or something, he would buy a soda or a juice. There was no bottled water back then. If it was a hot day and we all were doing something or playing in the park, Officer Johns would take money out of his pocket and buy ices, Italian ice. They call it water ice in Philadelphia. They're Italian ice in Brooklyn. And so this is the same officer that you had a respect for and your parents had a respect for that earned the community's trust. So if he roughed you up a little bit, it was okay. Now, the actual searching or the stop and frisk, and I sometimes call it stop and fish, occurred actually when I was an attorney. I was actually an attorney walking in some jeans and some sneakers and some clothing that I had from the cleaners. And I was walking, and I wasn't only an attorney, I was an assistant DA. I was walking to my home in Germantown, and it was a robbery that occurred on Shelton Avenue. And a patrol car came down, and he told me to stop, and I kept walking, and he told me to stop because I'm figuring he's not talking to me. I stopped. Now, mind you, I have cleaners in my hand, cleaner bag in my hand, suits in my hand, and I have a Stromboli in the other hand. He had me put that on the hood and began to search me. And when he began to search me, I said, hold on for a second. I want to see your supervisor. He didn't know who I was because I just was an African-American male walking down the street, Morris Street, towards the house that I lived in. The amazing thing about that is that even if I wasn't, who was I robbing with a cleaner's bag in a pizza box, a Stromboli box that was clearly hot when you felt it? And so I understand that. And I also understood it to a different level with my son. You know, my son was at school where he was supposed to be at the end of a basketball game, so it was evening, and he was waiting for my wife to pick him up. A patrol car came to where he was and asked him, what is he doing? And he said, I'm waiting to be picked up. Well, you have to move. Well, I told my mother that I would be here. Well, you have to move. She won't know where to find me. At that point, he didn't have his phone, or was either his phone had died. And at that point, he was searched. His ID was pulled, and they found out that he went to the high school, and he was really shook up for it. So it's not something that I learned about from somebody coming to my office. Something that I've experienced.
Okay. A lot of the candidates in this race say that this district attorney's office needs fundamental change, that it's been on the wrong track for a long time. Do you agree?
There are programs in it that work, but they need to be improved, and there are programs in there that don't work that need to be scrapped. I am not one of those that say you blow it up. No, you don't blow it up. If you blow it up, what are you replacing with it? But I am one that says that there has to be common sense reform by someone with the experience to reform.
Okay, let's be very specific. What's a change that needs to be made? How will you make it?
Well, there's a couple of things. The first and foremost, most important change is diversity. There has to be a change in the hiring practice and the recruitment. There is a lack of African-Americans, Hispanic, Asian, non-white individuals in the office. And what they bring, this diversity, is a diverse understanding and a diverse trust with the community.
We've had an African-American DA for 8 years. But that wasn't accomplished when he was there?
It wasn't accomplished because I think that the recruiting practices were abysmal. I thought that the hiring practices weren't good, and the hiring committee, not everyone, but some of the people that are involved in the hiring committee were looking for people like them as opposed to looking for people that would be good for the office.
Okay, so more diversity. What else would you do?
I would also include diversion programs. There are a lot there. There are some that are working good, but there are some that need to be adjusted.
And when we say diversion, we're talking about people arrested for nonviolent crimes.
Nonviolent offenses, some theft offenses, some drug offenses.
Sent to treatment and community programs rather than jail.
Rather than prison. However, under the diversion programs currently, they are arrested. And when they're arrested, they go through the process. And if they complete the diversion program, that arrest can be expunged, but it's still an arrest. What I suspect and what I believe will be more beneficial is rather than having someone with a scarlet letter, catch them before that.
The scarlet letter, the stigma of a felony
conviction. The stigma of
the
arrest of a felony conviction or even an arrest that's expunged. I challenge people when they say it's expunged, it's expunged. That just simply means that they're not supposed to look at it. It doesn't mean that they don't look at it. So I say you have diversionary programs and they'd be very specific in terms of specific crimes, but that it allows people to actually go through the process prior to the arrest. And if they complete it, then it's good.
A very controversial program in the DA's office is the asset forfeiture program, where they seize assets, money, cars, houses of people associated with investigations, sometimes not convicted, sometimes not charged. This is under legal challenge. What's your view of how it should run?
I think that that system is broken in that how it is applied. Someone has a constitution right now. I hear everyone talking about, well, it's civil and criminal. No, you can't just take someone's property. And there has been an analogy that has been going across this campaign. It sounds like everybody's trying to sound the same these days. But the grandmother, who was an innocent grandmother, having her house taken because her grandson is accused of selling narcotics out of that house. That should never occur if she's an innocent grandmother. Grandmothers, unfortunately, a lot of times in our community are raising their grandsons and great-grandsons.
That's the woman in West Philadelphia whose case is now before the state Supreme Court.
And so she shouldn't be punished for that. However, if it is a grandmother there that decides to be involved in the selling of narcotics, that person should be processed and prosecuted for that. And if proven beyond a reasonable doubt that they're guilty of selling and selling out of that house, using the house or as a drugstore, then in fact we should talk about whether or not they have a right to hold on to that house. But that should only occur after that person is convicted, and it should only occur if we can tie that house to the actual distribution of drugs.
You know, if there's somebody nobody in this race probably wants to stand next to, it's Seth Williams, the incumbent now under a corruption indictment. You're old friends. You've known him for a long time. You served for 7 months as his chief deputy until very recently. What should people think of Seth Williams and your association with him?
Well, I don't know, and I can't respond to what they should think of Seth Williams. But what I think they should think of when they say that I'm associated with him is the same thing they think about anyone that were their friends or their family or someone they grew up with or a schoolmate that may have been accused of doing something wrong. Doesn't necessarily mean that you did anything wrong because you knew them or because you know them in a different light. What they should know with a certainty is that during the course and time of all of the investigation, any of the activity in which he's charged with, any of the allegations that are indicating he did something corrupt or something criminal, had nothing to do with me and I was nowhere around. They should know that I was brought into that office to clean up that exact thing. I was brought into that office to, in fact, make sure that the office morale was picked up, to, in fact, begin to do criminal justice reform, to run the office, to do things that were positive and proud for district attorneys and for the city of Philadelphia.
So for 7 months, you were at a policymaking level in the office. Some of the changes that you'd like to make, could you do them then? Was there enough time?
A lot of them were began. We began them there, and absolutely it wasn't enough time. What we did is we rewrote the police shooting protocol. And in rewriting the police shooting protocol, it required that an assistant DA, and most of the times it was me, go out to the scene at the time. So when you go out to the scene, you're able to observe what's going on. It gives a level of trust to the community because you can see whether or not someone is doing something they have no business doing. We also, in that protocol that we rewrote, devised a protocol for sitting down with the victim's family. In other words, if someone was shot by an officer, or accused or not accused, if someone was killed by an officer, then we would sit down with that person, their family member, their wife, their mother, their father, to the end of it, and explain to them what the evidence looks like. As we gather that evidence, let them see what we see, what we're looking at, why are we examining this, and how we can come to a particular conclusion. Remember, one of the things that have been argued about that, that there was no transparency. But now we would have transparency and, in fact, invite their attorney in as well with going on to that.
And what about releasing the names of an officer?
Well, that's something that is legislatively that is being prohibited at this time. Am I for releasing the names? Absolutely I am. We can't have a situation when someone is accused of something. Their name is released and immediately we put out they stole a sandwich at age 13, but have an issue when an investigation is going on with a police officer who was taken off the street and nobody talk about that officer at all. Now, it has to be a caveat with that. That has to be more so on a case-by-case basis. What do I mean by that? Depending on the compromising of the investigation, depending on the danger that may exist, at a particular time, you may not release it immediately. But clearly, there should be people that know who this officer is and what's going on at the appropriate times during the course of the investigation.
Well, that's tricky, though, isn't it? Not releasing it immediately. What's the appropriate time? Movements build because people feel they're being stonewalled.
Well, and I think that movements build because people are feeling stonewalled because they know nothing. Now, when we talk about releasing the name, there's certain other things that we're doing differently or that in that protocol calls to do differently that didn't exist before that. For example, the relative was never brought into the office. Relative wasn't allowed to review all that information. The relative wasn't allowed to have a conversation, something explained to them. Now, the reality of it is, how can you explain to a mother that their son is shot and killed? There's no satisfactory answer that you can give that person. But you can let them see what you're looking at. Explain to them the law and the nuances between Joe Citizen firing a weapon and deadly force used by a police officer, because there's a vast difference legislatively. Legally, there's a difference. And it's often that difference that deals with whether or not someone is charged or not.
You have some tax debts that have come up in the campaign. It's been reported you have tax liens of $137,000 to the IRS, about $50,000 to city, $2,500 to the state. Those numbers about right?
No, the numbers absolutely aren't right. The IRS, for example, I've grown up in Brooklyn, but I've lived in Philadelphia for approximately 30 years. For two decades, I had a business, small business. I have an attorney. I had an accountant who prepared my taxes. And I might add that all of my taxes, any income I received, I reported. And I didn't ever try to hide it or try to lean. And then I get audited or my taxes get looked at and the IRS say that, no, we're not going to take those deductions. You owe this money. We begin to have a dispute, the IRS and myself, and I'm a hell of a lawyer, but I haven't beat the IRS yet. And so penalties and interest begin to accrue. All of those things happen. Mind you, I pay my taxes, but I'm disputing these.
Okay.
With regard to city, the amount that's being stated are in litigation and dispute, and that's why they're there. And so they will be in litigation and dispute, and until I'm able to actually resolve that, then that appears the way it is.
You have a distinctive look. You have a full beard. The lower half is bright red. People must ask you about it. Is it it's of religious significance, is it?
There is religious significance, but there's cultural significance as well. I think that there are other cultures that, in fact, use henna to dye their beard or to henna on their hands to put tattoos. It's to that degree. The red that people talk about, it's gray. That's actually gray hair.
It was gray.
And the only reason the lower half is red is because the other part isn't gray yet. Because what henna does is it only attaches to the gray. So anyone knows about that vegetable material would know that, no, this is somebody who has gray hair. But I anticipate going through this campaign, it all may be red soon because it may all be gray.
Tariq El-Shabazz, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me, Dave.